April 7th, 1973. My name is Janelle Jones Shepherd, and I live in Portland. I interviewed Mrs. Madeline M. Stone, as she signs herself usually. She's an alert lady in her 70s, about 5'2", slim, and in good health, white-haired, of course, and with bright blue eyes. She's done a lot of writing about historical events, and she's well qualified since she has lived in Portland since 1900. She grew up here in Portland, and she has been here during all the events of the years and during the storms of the 1916 and 1919. However, she doesn't dwell much on the weather, or the happenings of the weather, or of the family events, but she concentrates on the people who have passed this way and the mark they left and how they managed while they were here. In this tape, Mrs. Stone tells Portland's history from the time that it was a grant. She talks about Senator Willoughby and other early people, such as the man who made the first store here, W.A. McHarry. She touches on all the phases of pioneer life, the hunting boom, the railroad building, the schools, the transportation, the stories that she's heard through her life. Her article that she wrote as a reminiscence about the oyster reef passage is interesting, and she also wrote an article for her mother about the hardships that her mother had when she came here, establishing a home and maintaining it. During the interview, there were a few noises, as you will hear. The heater came on, and the phone bell rang, and the doorbell. But Mrs. Stone kept to the line of what she had prepared, her prepared notes, and I think that this adds to the authenticity of her material that she has on the recorded interview. In questions that are not on the tape, she discounted things about ghost tales and folk tales. She was not interested in these things. She counted them as superstitions. And always she swung back to her main interest about the progress that has been made and how it was made. To begin the interview, she tells about the plat of Portland, the land here, and how it passed from hand to hand. I might add that the city of Portland, as it now is situated, is north across the Nueces Bay from Corpus Christi in San Patricio County.
Okay. The land on which Portland is located was given to Monroe J. McLean for his service in the Texan Army in the War of 1836 with Mexico. He received a certificate of bounty land from the Republic of Texas dated October 7, 1836. On October 9, 1836, for the sum of $75, he gave a power of attorney to Samuel Whiting to locate the land and convey the same for his own benefit. The land was surveyed February 1859. Samuel Whiting sold to Henry Smith for $300. In 1873, the land became the property of Coleman, Mathis, and Fulton, and later became Coleman Fulton Pasture Company property. This information was obtained from an abstract which I have. In the 1930s and 40s and early 1950s, I was the Portland correspondent for the Corpus Christi Caller, and in 1939, they got out a historical edition, and they asked me to write some articles. I borrowed a picture of John G. Willoughby, the founder of Portland, from his niece, Mrs. Ralph Devine, in Corpus Christi, and wrote this article. J. John G. Willacy was born near Louisville, Kentucky, November 10, 1859. He will observe his 80th birthday anniversary this week, which was in 1939. He located in Corpus Christi in 1890 and promoted and platted the town site of Portland, Texas, just across the bay. He moved to Portland and became one of the leading truck growers of the coast section. Elected to the legislature, the House of Representatives, in 1899, he served 4 years, following which he was elected to the state Senate, where he served 12 years, during which time he was elected as president pro tem for 3 consecutive terms. As evidence of esteem upon the part of his colleagues, Willacy County bears his name. Appointed tax commissioner in 1922, he served for 4 years, and following this period, he was engaged in the publication of Willacy's Facts and Fiction, a tax periodical. Although now a resident of San Antonio, his greater attachment, as he puts it, is for Corpus Christi and Portland. Senator and Mrs. Willacy have 2 children, May, wife of Marshall Eskridge, attorney of San Antonio, and Maud, who with her husband, General W. E. Prosser, are stationed at Fort Douglas, Salt Lake City, where General Prosser is commanding officer. Senator Willacy and R.A. Arnold married sisters, and Senator Willacy was instrumental in bringing Mr. Arnold and his family to Portland in 1891. A native of Hopkins County, Kentucky, Arnold's early life was spent railroading. After moving here, he was engaged in truck farming and had a produce buying and shipping business, a seed house, and a grocery store. In later years, he was engaged in the real estate business and served as county commissioner for many years. He died in 1925 at the age of 76. Relatives in this section are a grandson, Robert Arnold, of Corpus Christi, and a great-niece, Mrs. C.C. Carroll, of Portland. The second article in this 1939 historical edition is about W.A. McHarry, the first Portland merchant, and his grocery store was the first frame building in a tent town. W.A. McHarry was Portland's first merchant. His one-room grocery store was the first frame building to be completed in the town, which was then a tent city of 600 or 800 people. He later built a large store and dwelling combined, 2 stories, which was a landmark for many years. The 1919 storm damaged the building, and it was torn down in 1931. Mr. McHarry was born in 1835 at Louisville, Kentucky. When a small boy, he moved to Illinois, where his father had a flour mill. As a young man, he worked in his father's mill and later had a freight line over the mountains in Colorado before the railroad was built through the Royal Gorge. His health became impaired, and he came to Corpus Christi for his health, then located in Portland in 1891. D.C. Richelle, S.G. Barden, George Cleespies, and Mr. McHarry operated a forwarding company and had a wharf which extended about 1,200 feet into Corpus Christi Bay. 600 or 700 bales of cotton would be shipped each season, some of it coming from as far inland as Beeville. Boats which brought lumber into Corpus Christi would take on the cotton. In addition to his mercantile interests, Mr. McHarry bought and cleared land and carried on farming operations. He was of an inventive turn of mind and would whittle small wooden models of farm machinery and have his invention patented. He would have a well-known factory make one implement for his own use, but would steadfastly refuse to sell his patent. His death occurred in 1920. Relatives in this section are his daughter, Mrs. Frank Lang, and granddaughter, Miss Marguerite Lang, who are now living in Corpus Christi, but are building a home on the farm near Portland, which Mr. McHarry put into cultivation. A third article from this November 5, 1939 issue of the Corpus Christi Caller Times tells about a pioneer Portland resident living in this section for 71 years. Mrs. R.K. Reed has lived in this section for 71 years. A native of Scott County, Mississippi, she was 2 years old when her father died. Soon thereafter, with her mother, brother, and 2 sisters, she sailed on the old steamship Mary and landed in Rockport in 1868. About 10 years later, the family moved to San Patricia County, living on the Stokely Ranch near where the town of Sinton is now located. Mrs. Reed's brother, William Lilly, worked for the Coleman Fulton Pasture Company. In 1886, Mrs. Reed married. Her late husband came from near Monroe, Louisiana, and worked first for T.A. Coleman on the Coleman Ranch, and later was foreman of the Coleman Fulton Pasture Company Ranch. The first 11 years of the Reed's married life was spelt on the Picacho, P-I-C-A-C-H-O, Ranch near White Point. And sometimes Mrs. Reed did not see a white woman for 3 months at a time. Her nearest neighbor was the late Mrs. D.C. Rochelle. Mr. Reed died in 1934. Living with Mrs. Reed is her daughter, Mrs. Alice Ray, a son, Luther Reed, and a daughter, Mrs. T.E. McKibben, lives in Corpus Christi. Another daughter, Mrs. H.L. McCann, lives in Taft. 2 sons, Ross and George Arthur, live in Houston. Mrs. Reed also has 2 daughters living out of the state, Mrs. Arthur Mister of Brandywine, Maryland, and Mrs. William Peeren in Portland, Oregon.
He was a fence rider, huh?
Mm-hmm. I didn't say that, did I?
I don't know, but you mean he patrolled? Why did he ride?
To see where the fences were broken.
Oh, did they have Indian trouble back then, too?
Well, I don't know about that, but if a fence was down, of course the cattle would get out.
Okay.
A fourth clipping from the November 5, 1939 issue of the Caller Times has the heading, Portland Pioneers Had Many Interesting Experiences. Cigar factory once located at Portland. Mrs. Melissa Ann Smith, born in 1830 on a plantation near Humboldt, Tennessee, but a resident of Lexington, Kentucky most of her life, moved to Portland in 1891 when the Towns Act was first laid out. With her were her son-in-law and daughter, Mr. and Mrs. Louis P. DeMouche, and her 2 sons, George and Ed Fisher. Louis P. DeMouche was born in Brussels, Belgium, of French parents in 1854. His father, Louis Pierre DeMouche, was a general in the French army and was killed in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. The younger DeMouche, a lad in his teens, along with all the women and children, suffered the tortures of war, being besieged in Paris without food or water. After the war was over, Louis Jr. joined the standing army in France and became a lieutenant and fought for French possessions in Africa. He went with a battalion of 500 men, and only 50 returned, the others having died from hardships and fever. DeMoose then went to London and learned the cigar-making trade. He also began the study of music and finished in Leipzig and Rome, later singing in grand opera in many foreign countries. Coming to America, he joined the Boston Ideals and sang in most of the larger cities in this country. At one time, he sang with Adelina Patti in a concert in Fort Worth. In that city, he was married to Miss May Fisher, daughter of Mrs. Melissa Smith. Tired of travel, he established a large cigar factory in Fort Worth, moving to Portland in 1891, where he established a cigar factory. He has three children, Louis H. DeMoose, postmaster at Portland today, Mrs. D.C. Hunter of Hebronville, and Mrs. W.B. Davis of Trinidad, Colorado. Mrs. Davis, who was Haiti DeMoose, was the first white child born in Portland. Mr. DeMoose died in 1916 in Trinidad. Mrs. DeMoose resides in Corpus Christi. In the 90s and early 1900s, George and Ed Fisher hauled hunters to the famous duck hunting resort at Gumhalla. Many prominent people came from all over the United States and from several foreign countries, some in private railroad cars which were sidetracked here during the hunter's stay. Some came under assumed names, not wishing their identity known. Some nationally known included ex-president William Howard Taft, William Jennings Bryan, Samuel Clemens, who was Mark Twain, ex-governor Tom Marshall of Indiana, afterwards vice president with Woodrow Wilson, Colonel E.H.R. Green, Ed and George Gould. Mrs. Smith had the hunter's home where the sportsman lodged. She died in 1909. George Fisher died in 1917, and his widow and son, James G. Fisher, are residents of Corpus Christi. Mr. and Mrs. Ed Fisher reside in Portland. Mr. Fisher also operated a cigar factory in Portland after Mr. DeMoose moved away. At one time, he experimented with raising Havana tobacco in this section on a small plot and had a very good crop. He used the tobacco as a filler in his cigars and also bought tobacco raised by farmers in the Rockport area.
About the hunters that came down here?
Okay. In the 1890s and early 1900s, my father, Ed Fisher, and his brother, George Fisher, hauled the hunters about 3 miles out to Gumhalla. And the Coleman Fulton Pasture Company had made an earthen dam, and there was cane growing on the shoulders of it in order to help hold the soil, and there was a passageway in between the two rows of cane, and it was a hunter's paradise. The dam impounded water on the north side of the dam, and just on the south side was the saltwater of Nueces Bay, and the hunters would sit on ammunition boxes in the cane break, and they could bang away at the, seemed like millions of ducks as they flew over.
And you mean it was salt water on one side and fresh?
And fresh water on the other. The dam was put up there so that for water for the company's cattle. That was what it was for, but it made the finest, one of the most famous duck hunting places anywhere around. And as was told in one of the clippings, you know, all the famous people who came here. My father said that Mark Twain was the funniest man that he ever listened to, and he would have boys, some Mexicans, some white boys, I suppose, to go out there and wait on the hunters, and they'd get oysters and put them over a bed of hot coals, and the shells would open, you know, and they'd have oysters on the half shell, and they'd kill a javeline hog, and they would probably barbecue it, I don't know.
Have a feast, huh?
And between here and, but anyway, let me go back. Mark Twain would tell so many funny stories that these hands, you know, that were waiting on them would just roll with laughter, just roll on the ground. And, there's a lot of sticky black mud between here and Gum Hollow, and they had these light wagons that they called spring wagons that they used in hauling the hunters, and the mud would cake in the wheels, and they'd have to take shovels along, you know, to free the wheels of enough of the mud to where they could make it. And oh, and another thing about William Jennings Bryan, there was a boat out there because I have some pictures of my father and two ladies in a boat. One of the ladies was quite a good shot. But then there was William Jennings Bryan was here, he was quite famous. He was known as a silver-tongued orator, and he ran for president two or three times. And he is so famous for that, isn't it the Stokes trial in Tennessee, you know? Yeah.
Monkey.
Yeah, and Clarence Darrow. Defended the young school teacher who was teaching this theory of evolution. But William Jennings Bryan was wearing a long frock tail coat, and when they took him out on the lake, one of his coat tails got in the water and got wet. I have a picture of him taken over in Corpus Christi, but Mrs. Sparks has it now. I'd like for you to see it later. But I don't know when the earthen dam washed out, and of course after that, the duck hunt was destroyed. But this E.H.R. Gould, his mother was famous for playing the stock market. She was
a
very wealthy woman. Yes, I've read stories in the paper about her. She was so frugal, and she'd have an old black skirt, and she had a pocket in it, and she'd carry a sandwich with her, and she'd go and play the stock market and stay there all day. So she gave her son some E.H.R. Green. Did I say Gould?
Gould, like that.
Now, the Goulds were down here in their private car, but this was E.H.R. Green.
Green.
Colonel E.H.R. Green. You're going to have to do something about that.
No, that's all right.
He came in his private car, and my father took his party out a couple of days, but he was so obnoxious that my father wouldn't take him anymore.
What's the matter? He drank or just...
Overbearing.
Oh, dominating.
I think my father charged $1 a day for hauling the hunters out there and looking after them while they were there, running errands for them. And they were here, I think, a couple of days. And anyway, the bill was $16. And he was standing on the back of his private car, and he threw them down at 16 silver dollars at my father's feet. And my father wouldn't pick them up. And the mayor of Fort Worth, I believe it was, wanted to pick them up, and Papa told him no. And so one of the colored porters on the car came and picked it up and handed it to Papa.
That was ugly. I mean, of him to throw it like that.
Mm-hmm.
But your father did use then sort of a supplementary income for the hunters coming in. Was that, what did your father do for his main living?
Well, in the early days, there was truck farming here, right across the street here, and down as far as, to beyond the overpass. My grandmother and my father owned it, and he and his brother did the truck farming. and just right there, this side of Gunderland's, between Gunderland's and the railroad track, was where Mr. Arnold had his packing shed. And the railroad station was right there at the railroad.
The railroad station?
Uh-huh, oh. There was
a depot.
A depot, something like the one at Gregory.
Yeah.
Could it be larger? And then when they opened the valley to truck gardening, well, those vegetables were earlier than what could be produced here. And they'd pick hampers of beans and ship them, and they wouldn't sell for enough to pay the express. So, of course, that destroyed the truck gardening here. And by that time, there was more land opened up to farming, and they went in heavily for cotton. And there was a cotton gin built just about where Blair's building is now.
Mm-hmm. There was.
And then there was another one across the railroad track on Coleman Fulton Pasture Company land. It was a CFP company gin about where Broadway is on the east side of the railroad track. And they also had a lumber yard up there.
Well, what happened to all of that? It seems strange that it's all gone now. It just wore out.
Well, my father came here in 1891, as I said, when the town was just being laid out. And everything was on a boom. There was railroads building out of Corpus and out of Victoria. Mm-hmm. And then the panic hit in 1893, and the bottom dropped out of everything, and everybody who could moved away. Mm-hmm. And Professor Clark came here in 1894 and established Bayview College, and in a clipping that I have, it said the railroad conductor said, "Well, what is he going to teach, jackrabbits?" That everybody is moving away. But he grew his students as a boarding school from the ranches.
I see, yeah.
But by 1916, there were so many towns building that they had their own schools that it destroyed the value of the Bayview College as a boarding school.
Yeah. They finally ran out of pupils then, I suppose. Or they went elsewhere, or more schools were built. Well, where did you go to school?
Well, from grades 1 through 7, I went to Bayview College.
They call it a college, although it was elementary, what we call now.
Well, Nell Sutherland, in his her article in this Portland Progress book, said that actually they did about junior college work. See, she was farther advanced, Miss Molly Turner taught 7 grades in one room, and she was a wonderful teacher.
What about getting back to that?
And there was...
7 grades. How many pupils were there, though, 7 grades in one room?
I don't know. I'd have
30.
Well,
30. More than 40.
I don't know. I can't remember.
That's a room full.
Yes, uh-huh. But Professor Clark, of course, taught the advanced subjects. And after he left here, he went to West Texas College at Canyon, and also taught at Cisco, and he taught languages. And he was a wonderful musician, and he even composed several pieces that I've heard him play. Now, the 1916 storm damaged that building, and the school trustees asked to put the public school down at Professor Clark's building, and so it was put down there, and that was my senior year, and I hadn't gone but a couple of days, and I came home crying. I said, "I'm not going to be able to graduate this year because I'm not getting the subjects that I need. And so my mother took me to Corpus Christi and put me in the high school there, and that's where I graduated.
Did you have to board there in Corpus
yes.
Christi?
Mm-hmm. Because the first causeway was concrete half of the way, and the other half was shell that was dredged and thrown up.
Mm-hmm.
And that washed away in the 1916 storm. And then the 19 storm took away all of that. And what caused it was that the railroad track gave way and beat against this Cut Creek part. And you can still see the remains of it at low tide.
Well, is that what all those posts
yes,
are?
Yes, it's between the old railroad track and the new causeway.
Well,
and then they built a wooden bridge. And of course, it took a while to build that. And for a period, well, they used a ferry. Ferry people.
Was that pretty slow, or did that?
Yes, people would almost rather go clear around by Odom than wait on the ferry.
Well, when did they build this bascule bridge that they had over here?
In 1926.
I remember going across that before the.
Yes, and that is, of course, across the port, and that where the port was dredged is what they called Hall's Bayou. And when they opened the new bridge, my cousin was president of the Portland State Bank, and they had a full-page ad in the Corpus Christi Caller. Of course, that was a big addition, that opening of the high bridge. And that was October 3rd, 1959. So he asked me to write a historical article to put in his ad for the paper. And so I wrote this article, and my cousin told me, and later I met one of the men from the Corpus Christi Caller, and they said that this was the first article that they had ever printed of a historical nature that a lot of people didn't phone or write and say it wasn't that way, it was this way. Hmm. And that this article created more comment than anything else that they had in that edition. So hmm. I'll read it.
Okay,
it's
I
about,
wish you would.
It's about how they found the oyster reef. The High Bridge, Gateway to Better Living in Portland. The ease and speed with which Corpus Christi can be reached today is a far cry from the travel difficulties encountered by the early settlers. In 1890, when the town site of Portland was founded, a traveler had two alternatives. He could go by rail, which entailed spending two nights in Corpus Christi in order to have one day for shopping or transacting business. There was only one train. It went south in the evening and north the morning of the next day. The other alternative was across the reef by spring wagon if the tide was low. A submerged oyster reef staked with large posts on either side of which travel was safe began and ended at approximately the same points as the present Nueces Bay Causeway enters and leaves the water. A large bend near the center of the reef forced traffic to go about a mile out of the way. Impatience caused many a team to be lost in quicksand when the driver tried to avoid traveling the extra distance by crossing the narrow neck of the bend. A Captain Crouch of the Texas Rangers gave this account of the discovery of the oyster reef. Following an Indian raid, the Rangers were chasing the intruders from south of Corpus Christi to the point of land now known as North Beach. Darkness fell, so the Rangers set up guards at Hall's Bayou, site of the present bascule bridge and turning basin. To prevent the Indians' escape and allow easy capture on the morn, When morning came, not an Indian could be seen. Their footprints were traced into the water. The oyster reef discovered and staked the travel. Reef travel was not simple. At the south end of the reef, location of an old riverbed, the water was deep. At that point, the horses had to swim, and water came up into the wagon bed, soaking any packages which the driver had neglected to move into the wagon seat. If a shopper was late in leaving town and darkness had fallen, he would lie down in the wagon bed and check the distance from the marker post by the phosphorus picked up by the horses. A little travel was done by rowboat. A few more hardy pioneers walked the railroad trestle. It is hard to believe that this was less than 100 years ago. Today, across the new high bridge and modern causeway, Portland is closer to downtown Corpus Christi than many of the outlying Corpus Christi housing developments. My father used to walk that trestle when he'd be caught over in Corpus and couldn't get home that evening. Well, his friends would take him in these little railroad push cars to the trestle, and he'd walk the trestle and walk on home.
What next?
Even one time when my mother was hungry for ice cream, he carried a freezer of ice cream to her.
Oh, my. He kept his balance. I was interested in that about measuring the distance by the phosphorus that was kicked up. What did you mean on that? They lay down in the wagon bed.
Well, I'm not very familiar myself with phosphorus, but I think it's some organism in the water that lets off a light.
And they could tell how far they were. Oh, I see.
But that bend went way out west. It just seemed like it was about a mile out of the way, and people who didn't know, and would cut across there, the horses would just, one horse would begin to sink, the other horse would begin to flounder, and they'd be lost.
That's interesting. I guess they got it to where they could drive cars across there then, too. I mean, when they built the road across there. They didn't follow the oyster bed reef, did they?
No. It began and ended close to where our present causeway ends. But it, as I said, made that bend.
Mm-hmm.
And on the south side, when you're nearing Corpus Christi, was an old Nueces River mouth, and it was deep. And that's where the horses had to swim.
Well, did you live here during World War I?
Yes, I lived here since 1900.
Yeah, since 1900.
From a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Talking about the early hardships, I have this clipping that the editor of the Portland Gregory Observer asked, the Corpus Christi Caller was having a lot of articles about the early days, and they'd hit it, "I Remember When," and a girl from Corpus came over here and interviewed my mother and took her picture and all. And so then this Portland newspaper, when my mother had her 88th birthday, they asked that she reminisce and tell about the early times. So,
that was interesting. Go ahead.
Saturday marked the 88th birthday of Mrs. E.C. Fisher, one of Portland's oldest pioneer residents. She is a native of Victoria, Texas, and was married there in 1899 to the late Edmund C. Fisher. Mr. Fisher had moved to Portland in 1891 when he was a teenager and while a town site was being laid out. The promoters and early residents had high hopes and great expectations for the growth of the town, but with the panic of 1893, the boom broke and most of the people moved away. That was when Mr. Fisher went to Victoria to find employment, although he always claimed Portland as home, and he would ride horseback 85 miles through the country to cast his vote here. The couple moved to Portland in 1900. Mrs. Fisher found a tiny village with only a few dozen houses and brush all over the town, and she thought it was the jumping-off place. Mrs. Fisher recalls the shortage of water was the greatest hardship. Rainwater caught in cisterns was the only water supply, and during prolonged droughts, when the supply was exhausted, it was necessary to haul water in barrels on wagons. Water at 50 cents a barrel could be obtained from the lake at Gumhalla, which was located in the ravine west of the present site of Hunt's Airport. Cattle stood in the water, so it was settled with wood ashes and was suitable only for washing clothes. Later, the earthen dam washed out and the lake drained away. Water hauled from Gregory or Oak Motts near the present West Portland Gin cost $1 a barrel. When the shortage of water became more acute, it was shipped by rail from Skidmore in a tank car. Ice, fresh vegetables, and fresh meat were rarities in the summer. Once a week, meat was brought from Gregory in a wagon and peddled from door to door. Bayview College was a center of social and cultural activity in the early days. There was no church building or organized congregation in the town. Union services were held at Bayview College, and any itinerant minister was welcome to preach. Lacking a preacher, the late Professor T.M. Clark, founder of the college, preached wonderful sermons. He had many talents, spoke and taught several languages, was a splendid musician, and had unusual acting ability. An occasional three-act play given by advanced students and faculty was a treat to be looked forward to, and 3 days of commencement exercises closed the school year. Mrs. Fisher enjoys reading and watching TV, and her hobby is crocheting. She has crocheted 14 bedspreads, donating one to the National Grandmothers Club Haven Fund and two to the Portland Youth Center. She resides at 313 7th Street. She has lived on the same land for 60 years, although the present home was built after the 1919 storm damaged the first home. She has one daughter, Ms. Madeline Stone, who makes her home with her mother. Two grandchildren, Mrs. Nadine Strom of 702 Elm Street, Portland, and Mrs. Gaynell Levine of Santa Mauritius, New York, and three great-grandchildren, Darylyn Lee Strom and Jeffrey Duane Strom, and Andrew Edwin Levine and Toby Reynolds Levine in New York.
What year was that? What date? I didn't catch that.
When November 23rd, 1960.
She celebrated her 88th birthday.
And she passed on in 1964.
She'd be a long time.
Yeah, she's 92.
92 years old. Mm-hmm.
She had just passed her birthday in 19th of November, and she passed on in December. But of course, she told me all this. Well, I'd heard so much of it always, but I wrote this.
You wrote that?
For the paper. They asked me to have her reminiscence. Mm-hmm. I wrote it for her. But, let me see, there's something in here that reminded me of something I wanted to go back to. I believe in this family one. It tells that my father was in the the cigar factory of Mr. DeMuccia's?
Mm-hmm.
Did it? Was that in it?
Oh.
So he went up there to work for his brother-in-law in the cigar factory. That isn't on there, is it?
Yes, it's... I'll turn it back on you. You look at that. Don't worry about it. But he worked in you in his brother-in-law's cigar factory or his brother's?
His brother-in-law, DeMuccia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you'll turn it on.
Yeah, I believe we've done.
W.A. McHarris' store not only carried groceries, and it had general merchandise, kerosene, shoes, hardware, a few small implements, ribbons, pins, lace, cigars, cigarettes, and the shoes were button or lace high top shoes. And she said that the Mexicans would come in and buy their groceries. They'd come in barefooted with their heads all wrapped up. And these shoes didn't sell. And Mr. McHarris, daughter wanted him to mark them down in price, and he refused to do that, but he said she could give them away as cologne. So when the Mexicans would come in, she would give them as cologne to them.
As cologne?
No.
That must be a Spanish word. I don't understand. I don't know.
It's like a little gift, you know.
Oh,
a little, something extra.
A cologne is like a gift, some sort of regalo.